one of the Navy admirals responsible for the fire support efforts at Tarawa tells his Marines that we don't intend to destroy the island, we intend to obliterate it.
This is Preble Hall. Welcome to Preble Hall, a podcast about naval history from the United States Naval Academy Museum in Annapolis.
Welcome back to another episode, and joining us today is a guest from far, far away, from across the street, Sampson Hall at Naval Academy in the History Department, Captain Chris Hemler, United States Marine Corps, who will be discussing Tarawa and amphibious operations during World War II with us today. Chris, welcome across the street to Preble Hall.
Dr. Barabee, thank you for having me. I've been a fan of Preble Hall for a little time now, so it's an honor to be with you.
Chris, what's your background?
So I am a Marine, as you've already introduced us to. I'm also a graduate of our grounds here, of the Naval Academy, 2012. So I had a pretty quick track back here. Was fortunate to get a path that brought me back as an instructor and, doing something I love, teaching history, a recent passion of mine that has kind of come through some of my experiences in the Marine Corps. And it's great to be back here. My background in the Corps in particular, I'm an air support control officer. And I think as we get into our conversation today, we'll see that some of my professional background and my practical background in the Marine Corps kind of grew an interest in the history of how the Navy and Marine Corps coordinate amphibious operations, how they've done it effectively and ineffectively in the past. And so that spurred quite a bit of my interest in my research.
And I should say you're working on your doctoral dissertation right now. You're really into it.
I am, and that's a good way to put it. I'm just over halfway, maybe approaching two-thirds on what I think will be a finished product. What I hope will be a finished product.
I've read
right?
your first three chapters. Really fantastic.
Right. And thank you. I've got a few more chapters kind of swirling with my advisor right now, and then a few more to write. So. I'm working at Texas A&M with Professor Brian Lynn, a really well-known military historian. Does a lot of work on the U.S. Army, but he's terrific, and he's agreed to continue working with me on trying to summit PhD Mountain. So
what's the topic specifically?
We're going to talk about many of these themes today, but it's how the Marine Corps and the Navy more generally learn to coordinate what I call trifibious firepower, and that is offshore naval gunfire support and air support during the Pacific campaigns. And so, it's a story of wartime adaptation. It's a story of bloody lesson learning, and it's something I find fascinating.
Now, nothing appears out of a vacuum, especially in military operations, and if we're going to focus on Tarawa, the story really begins decades before, doesn't it?
It does. It certainly does. And it has a lot of history with the Marine Corps as an institution and what it's trying to do in the 20th century. And so the Marine Corps emerges from the First World War with a new degree of credibility, maybe a newly established reputation with the American people, the stories of Bella Wood and Marine heroism and courage. All these things are great for the Corps, but they're not an enduring mission. They're not something that's going to keep the service around in the long term. And
because
so,
the Marine Corps always had a challenge, going right back to the beginning, that there were some people who simply wanted to subsume the Marine Corps into the Army. There were people that just said, there were certain Marine commandants who just said, no, we'll just go with ship's company. You know, the traditional age of sail method.
That's right, and that threat becomes acute at the end of the 19th century as the new Navy emerges and the services are professionalizing, and so there's not as much need for these ship's guards detachments, as they were called. The good order and discipline crews on board ship, and the snipers, of course, in battle, but these missions were evaporating for the Marines, and so they needed a claim to protect their purpose, and so that will slowly become, it'll become expeditionary duty as they serve in the Great War and as they serve in the Banana Wars, but the amphibious mission is really what they begin to cling to in the interwar period.
Why is that?
Well, it certainly preserves their connection with the Navy, and it builds on developments in the U.S. Navy. It builds on Mahan's idea of advanced base operations and coaling stations, and so I think it builds on the history of the Marine Corps and also, you know, charts a new path for them to protect the institution.
Did the Navy establishment see this as a threat to their autonomy because now they see that the Marine Corps is trying to find not necessarily a new mission, but also it's a mission that's going to require new equipment. And when you're talking about new equipment, you're talking about money, and you're talking about money that might be put to other things in the Navy. Because the Marine Corps doesn't buy, for example, an LHD,
right,
or LPD. Right. That's going to be part of the Navy budget. Is there any resistance in the 1920s specifically?
That's a great question. I'm not sure I'm enough of an expert on the Navy at that period to know how they perceive it. I think threat might be a little too strongly worded there. Certainly, the Navy wonders where it's going to prioritize the Marine Corps, right? Where it's going to prioritize amphibious warfare. And that will become a point of friction between the Navy and Marine Corps. I'm not sure that becomes a threat to the Navy, but certainly they don't want it to become more important than it ought to be. And so the Navy is still, throughout the 1920s and 30s, focused on largely surface engagements. And again, the ideas of Mahan and decisive battles at sea, and so they tend to see amphibious operations as a tangential purpose, a distraction at times, and even for advocates of carrier warfare that's emerging, they don't want to play second fiddle, right? No one wants to play second fiddle to a Marine landing, and so that'll be a point of disagreement that will pop up in the early campaigns of World War II.
Does this emerge in the 1920s as a result of, say, War Plan Orange, because, you know, in the Atlantic, you don't have a lot of island change. You've got the Azores, et cetera, but it's not like the Pacific. Is it specific to a potential war with Japan that the Marine Corps is trying to justify this new role?
It is. The Marine Corps sees the looming conflict with Japan as an opportunity here. As it's thinking about the amphibious mission, certainly the conditions in the Pacific, the growth of Japan, the eventual deterioration of diplomacy with Japan, all of that provides opportunity for the Marine Corps to be the specialist. And so if we're going to talk about the 1920s Marine Corps, we're going to talk about names like John Lejeune, Pete Ellis.
That was my next question. Who are the big thinkers?
Are going to come up, and they have they're looking at Japan. This is an opportunity, not only for that mission that we just talked about, that enduring mission for the Marine Corps, but it's a present opportunity for the Marine Corps to contribute to defense and even offensive operations in the Pacific.
Can you elaborate on what Lejeune and Ellis brought to the table in the 1920s?
So if we're talking about the 1920s Marine Corps, the two names that we've got to recognize are John Lejeune and Earl Pete Ellis. And we should pause maybe for a brief moment here and recognize the pronunciation Lejeune that is out there, right? And some of the descendants of John Lejeune continue to try to tell the Marine Corps today that Lejeune is the proper French pronunciation here. But Marines are stubborn, and when they're taught one way, when it becomes a habit, and that's tough to break. So most Marines continue to pronounce it as Lejeune and Camp Lejeune, of course, mm-hmm. down in North Carolina today. But Lejeune is a major reformer in the Marine Corps, and he's a modernizer. He reforms a lot. He reforms the professional education of the Marine Corps. I would argue reforms kind of the leadership philosophy of the Marine Corps.
How does he change the education?
He begins to take it seriously.
He must be one of the first commandants to have graduated from the academy. Then, because we don't have a graduate who goes direct to the Marines until 18. Geez, I think it was 1888 or 89. I'll put it in the show notes. I apologize.
You're in the right window there. So Lejeune is from that first batch of graduates here, and he was actually discouraged by some of his mentors on the yard. He ranked fairly highly in his class. I'm not sure exactly where he graduated, but he was discouraged from commissioning in the Marine Corps because you know, that was the service for I hate to say it, but the misfits, right?
That was traditional for the 19th century. You see the writings of naval officers who are describing the Marines of the 19th century. So the culture changes significantly with, you know, whether it's the Boxer Rebellion, the Philippines, the actions in Central and South America. You're right.
So Lejeune is from that first batch, and you know, he's a visionary. He's a visionary for the Marine Corps. He's going to take professional military education very seriously. He's going to help to establish some new schools down in Quantico. He's going to even begin to educate and train young enlisted Marines in new ways. And he really views the officer's role as he's famous for viewing this as a father-son relationship, that an officer should care for the welfare of his Marines, that he should return them to American society as better citizens after they serve. It's not simply about their performance in the military. It's about making better citizens, making a good contribution to the welfare of the nation. And so Lejeune really reforms that idea that I think remains with us today in the 21st century Marine Corps.
How about Pete Ellis?
So Pete Ellis is a much more interesting character, I would say. Not that Lejeune isn't, but Ellis is just, gets a lot of attention and deserves it. Ellis is, on one hand, he's a brilliant strategic thinker.
He's a junior officer at this point. Captain, major during the 1920s.
He's a major in the interwar period. He'll eventually promote to lieutenant colonel, though I'm not sure if that's a posthumous promotion. I'd have to check that. Ellis is a brilliant strategic thinker, and he's also a drunk. He struggles with alcoholism throughout his life. It'll eventually be the death of him on a reconnaissance mission to the Pacific, where he'll drink himself to death. But he had a brilliant military mind, and Lejeune recognized that early on. In fact, there's a terrific quote from Lejeune when he's serving. Ellis is actually Lejeune's adjutant in Europe during the First World War, and one of Lejeune's subordinates come to him and says, "Sir, Ellis is inebriated again." And Lejeune snaps back that, "I prefer Ellis drunk to any of you sober," or something along those lines that he'll take.
It's almost like a Lincoln quote about Grant.
It is. And of course, we can speculate if Lejeune was familiar with that quote, but maybe he's just building on Lincoln's quip here. But I think that captures what Lejeune saw in Ellis. And even with his weaknesses, you know, Ellis had a bad temper, and he didn't play that well with others. He kind of lacked sandbox skills that just to kind of get along with other people, but he was absolutely brilliant, and Lejeune recognized that. So shortly after the First World War, Lejeune becomes commandant, which comes around in 1920, he puts Ellis in particular on studying this problem in the Pacific, studying how the Marines might advance across the Central Pacific, how they might seize enemy shorelines, and kind of the techniques that are going to deliver success for the Marines. So Ellis spends several years before he dies studying that very problem for the Marine Corps.
Are they looking into the platforms as well as the plans?
I would say Ellis is more focused on the operational plans and kind of the principles of an amphibious assault, although the equipment will certainly follow with that. You know, Ellis really recognizes a few things. What one of his famous quotes I like to share with my students as I teach this, Ellis writes that an amphibious attack will succeed or fail practically on the beach. That those are the words that he uses. And he already realizes what the Marines will learn in 1943, 1944, the idea that tempo and momentum are crucial to an amphibious assault, that once you get that toehold ashore, the ability to surge it, the ability to reinforce it very, very quickly will make all the difference in the attack.
How does this translate into what happens in the 1930s with regard to the manuals that are developed as well as the exercises and what they learn from them?
So this sets up a deliberate shift for the Marine Corps to think. We come out of Lejeune, we come out of Ellis's period, and the Marine Corps is now thinking intentionally about offensive amphibious war. And I think I would contrast that with the idea of Mahan's advanced base, where the Marines would kind of, you know, stroll onto an undefended shore and build it up as a potential coaling station or a potential port. But here, under Lejeune and Ellis and into the 1930s that you referenced, the Marines are now thinking about taking an enemy shoreline, right? Seizing it from a defended, protected, determined enemy. And that's what Ellis really begins to think about. So that shift feeds into what will become the tentative manual for landing operations, which the Marines will work on in the 1930s. At one point, the Commandant will actually shut down all of the professional schools in Quantico for slightly over a year. I think it's about 14 months. He shuts down all of the students' work and tells them to work on this manual, the tentative manual. So all the instructors, all the students are kind of doing their pioneering work. They're studying this problem and trying to produce this manual that will come out to several hundred pages about what it is to conduct an amphibious assault.
What are some of the exercises that are conducted during the 1930s?
This preparation, this theoretical preparation, will feed into the Navy's famous fleet landing exercises, the flexes, as we call them, of the mid and late 1930s. And so those will be the primary operational. I mean, the Marines back into the 1920s are playing around a little bit with some exercises, but it's really the flexes where they'll begin to address some of these problems and get more practical experience in the challenges of amphibious warfare.
What are some of the lessons they're learning from the flex?
Well, they learn quite a few lessons from the flexes. Probably the most pressing problem is landing craft, the equipment that are going to get the Marines from the transport ships onto the beach. And so they realize very quickly that their existing landing craft are number one, inadequate, and number two, far too few in supply. There just aren't enough of them.
What were they like?
They were rickety. They were unarmored.
They weren't self-propelled, I imagine.
In the 1920s, they're not self-propelled, but that'll change in the 1930s. And so as the Marines participate in the flexes, this is where we get the two most famous landing craft of the Pacific War. That'll become the Higgins boat, named after Andrew Higgins, and the Alligator, the Amtrak, amphibious tractor, which comes from another creative and entrepreneurial mind, Donald Roebling, another businessman similar to Andrew Higgins, and in working with the Navy Department in the 1930s and developing a craft that not only can get troops from ship to shore, but can do it with a tracked propulsion that'll be crucial when we get to Tarawa and we talk about the coral reef there.
Now, it's interesting because we've talked about the vision for the Marine Corps in amphibious operations. To what degree were they working with the Army? Because obviously the Army would get involved in amphibious operations. Obviously the most famous ones, I would say, are, you know, Torch in North Africa, Sicily, Italy, and certainly D-Day. Were the Marines and the Army, or was the Army learning anything from the Marines in the 1930s?
I would say they're not sharing as much information as they ought to.
So are they developing amphibious planning separately?
As war with Japan looms, the Army and Marine Corps kind of come to an agreement. They do come to an agreement that the Army is going to focus primarily on the Atlantic and European operations. There's a recognition right away that the struggle in Europe is going to require a much, much larger service than the Marine Corps. There's also a recognition that the Pacific War is going to be a naval affair, and particularly with the geography of the Central Pacific. I think the two services realize the Marine Corps, both in size and disposition, is suited for the Pacific, whereas the Army is suited for the larger and what will become more conventional land engagements once they land ashore.
When do the Marines start to test this amphibious training and planning that they had picked up for the past 10 years?
Right. So, again, the flexes begin to reveal some of the lessons that the Marines need to work on: landing craft, casualty evacuations, communications, even command relationships between the Navy and Marine Corps.
And even small things. I remember reading once where, you know, they had to figure out, apparently when they brought one of the boats ashore, you know, the ammo was down, you know, well below like the food and everything else. And the food isn't the first thing you think of when you're landing, you're going ashore. So they had to simply restructure their logistics to see what did they need exactly. It's almost like that old P.T. Barnum story where he increased the number of cities that he visited on his tour by changing the logistics, like taking the people out of the first car, taking the food out of the second car, taking the elephants who will come to the food.
Exactly. So yeah. So that idea that we have today, that we cherish today in the Navy Marine Corps, combat loading, right? Putting things in their proper sequence for an offload, that is not quite solved yet. They're learning about it during the flexes. Unfortunately, even at Guadalcanal, the Marines will be frustrated by the sequence of supplies and equipment and munitions. And so even in the early campaigns of the war, the Navy Marines are still learning to load their material properly for an amphibious.
Let's chat for a few minutes about Guadalcanal, and that's tough to do, you know, in a few minutes. But tell us what the Marine experience was specifically with regard to amphibious landings and what they learned.
Right. Definitely tough to cover in a couple of minutes, but that's what we'll do, right?
We'll do a whole episode later.
The historians, right? Always want more time to talk about what they have to say, right? So, Guadalcanal is a six-month campaign, and it's truly a campaign. It's much more than a battle. It's a drawn-out, protracted struggle between American and Japanese forces. And really what it becomes is a campaign of attrition, right? Who can replace their losses on the battlefield? The Japanese will reinforce by night. They'll continue to land small detachments of forces on the island of Guadalcanal. And the Marines will continue to reinforce themselves as well. And they'll also have what's becoming a steady supply of American industry. Aircraft, ships, munitions are all being by late 1942 being produced at a remarkable level in the United States, and that's beginning to get to the Pacific. So the Americans are positioned to win a battle of attrition, and that's what Guadalcanal becomes. In terms of amphibious operations, Guadalcanal highlights some of the challenges the Marines are going to face in this war, but it doesn't highlight all of them, and so it's an incomplete learning experience for the Marines. When they come ashore initially on Guadalcanal, August 7th, 1942, the 1st Marine Division really doesn't find any enemy resistance. There are a few hundred Korean laborers working on the airfield at Guadalcanal that the Japanese had been constructing. Those laborers flee into the jungle, and as one Marine recounts after the battle, you know, the first wave of assault troops are sitting on coconuts when he gets ashore. And so the Marines are shocked that this has transpired, that they don't have the resistance they had been anticipating. Now that resistance will come, it'll come quickly, and it'll last for almost 6 months. But it wasn't there at the beach. The Japanese detachment was very small in size and was not dug in to defending an amphibious assault. And so throughout the series of battles that will be the Guadalcanal campaign, the Marines do learn, they begin to learn about some combined arms warfare ashore. They're beginning to integrate the Cactus Air Force, as it becomes known, this small outfit of American aircraft that'll support the Marines on the ground. And so they're learning that air support and infantry operations are complementary, that one can protect the other. That their artillery pieces are quite valuable in direct fire support in helping to thwart these Japanese attacks that come throughout August, throughout September, and even into 1943. But what the Marines and the Navy don't learn is how to coordinate their actions on the beach, how to do it against a protected, established enemy that is waiting for you on the very vulnerable beachhead. And so that's the lesson that's missing at Guadalcanal. It's not a contested landing as the future operations in the Pacific will be.
It seems that with all the manuals and the training and the studies during the 1930s, why wasn't this anticipated?
It is anticipated. I don't think it's anticipated to the degree that the Japanese are going to present in this war. And so, during the flexes, the Marines are aware, of course, there are going to be enemy troops ashore. But for most of the flexes, the umpires, those officiating the exercises, they'll use stationary flags to show a Japanese unit ashore. And they'll use wooden targets to symbolize a Japanese bunker. Well, as the Marines and Navy offshore gunners will learn in the Pacific, those are far different enemies, quote unquote, than what they'll find in the Japanese. And so, you know, the flexes seem almost more like target practice than a real indication of combat against a fortified Japanese outpost, which they'll find everywhere beyond Guadalcanal.
How do they take the lessons learned from Guadalcanal and move forward from there? I mean, is there a unit that's providing after-action reports or studies about how they can do it better?
Certainly, all of these units are conducting the after-action reports and submitting them to their superiors and trying to think creatively about what to do better in the next contest. And so they are beginning to think about how to create similar maps. One of the things they lack at Guadalcanal, the aviators and the infantry units don't have the same map. Of course, they both have maps for Guadalcanal, but they're not in the same scale. They're not,
So you can't really call strikes on something. You can't find a grid on one map. You know, it's
right.
A3, strike on A3, and that other map doesn't even have right. letters
and
numbers.
Right, and if you can get to that strike, it's a delayed process. And perhaps even the time has elapsed and the target's no longer pressing.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. How was communications during Guadalcanal between the ground forces and air?
So we've got radios, of course. We have tactical radio sets emerging, but there are still, you know, ground units are still also using panels at that time as well. So we have a mix of communication between those on the ground and those in the air. So they're using panels to distinguish their front lines. They're using panels to perhaps call for air support, and then they'll also supplement with the radios. And eventually, the radios will become the primary method. Though we'll learn at Tarawa that those radios are not yet suited for amphibious combat. But we're communicating in both manners here at Guadalcanal, and the communication is not terrible. But again, at Guadalcanal, American forces are not pressed under the conditions of a chaotic assault at the surf's edge.
When does the United States decide to launch an amphibious operation against Tarawa?
That decision will come really during the campaign on Guadalcanal. American leaders will decide on their next target, and after the battle for Tarawa, it'll be a contentious issue of whether this island needed to be taken, whether it was worth. Of course, hindsight's 2020, and right. Americans will wonder after they lose 1,100 Marines and another 2,300 wounded for the tiny island of Baishio that sits in the Tarawa Atoll. They'll wonder if that was necessary. But American forces, they make the decision because they're going to continue to turn back the Japanese perimeter. They recognize that the next place to do that can be the Gilbert Islands, where the Tarawa Atoll lies. You know, they really have their eyes on the next chain that will come, and that is the Marshall Islands. But Chester Nimitz doesn't quite think his team is ready for that. The Marshalls is a much larger chain. The Japanese are much more established there and have more men there. And so the Gilberts is kind of a compromise. We can begin to turn back the Japanese perimeter on a much smaller scale and take a bite out of the cake, so to speak.
So what's the strategic value of Tarawa? Is it simply this particular island, is it simply the largest island in that chain that makes it that one key point that you have to control?
Well, it really comes down to the airfield. And so...
Was there an airfield already present?
There
Japanese?
Is. The Japanese have an airfield on the island of Baishio. And you know, to the Pacific War is a... of course, a long and massive conflict, but it's rather easy to summarize that this is a war for airfields. This is a constant fight for airfields across the Central Pacific. And so, in addition to turning back that Japanese perimeter, modestly at this point, the Americans realize that they want that airfield. And it's a, you know, to make the football analogy, it's a pick six. You take the airfield from the enemy, he no longer uses it, and now you put it to use with your own air forces.
What's the defense like for the Japanese on Baishio?
this is perhaps the largest contrast between Guadalcanal and the Battle for Tarawa in that the defense is established, the defense is dug in, it is engineered. The Japanese are ready for this assault. They know that it's coming. They've been preparing for several months. And the ranking Japanese commander there, Rear Admiral Shibasaki, will contest the American landing at the beach, and he'll be well positioned to do that. He has concrete bunkers. He has reinforced positions. He has machine guns and mortar fire all pre-registered, meaning it's ready to fire on the beach where the Marines are going to assault. He has 8-inch coastal defense guns to fire at the ships as they emerge over the horizon. He has thousands of mines strewn throughout the surf to blow up or at least distract minesweepers from the American fleet. And so this is an elaborate, highly developed defensive approach at Tarawa, and it'll really set the tone of the battles that will follow.
Who's in command for the U.S. side?
The Americans, there's an elaborate command structure. Raymond Spruance is of course, leading the 5th Fleet, but in tactical command, we'll have Marine General Holland Smith. He commands the Expeditionary Forces, and underneath him, we'll have Major General Julian Smith. He'll command the 2nd Marine Division, the outfit that will assault at Bacio.
There's some physical terrain difficulties with Tarawa for the Marines. Can you explain those? Because, I mean, it's not like you're, you know, going to the beaches of Cape Cod and, you know, you have a nice gentle surf that you're going up there. You have some nice beaches. Describe Tarawa and what makes it difficult for a lot of the Marine vehicles.
Mm-hmm. And this is where the conversation of landing craft will emerge again. So Tarawa is surrounded by a coral reef, and that coral reef, depending on the tide, depending on the conditions and the sea state, can have a few inches of water covering it, or it may have a few feet of water covering it.
Prior to the battle, did we have enough information about this particular aspect of the terrain?
That remains a debated issue. So we were certainly aware that the reef was there. We were certainly aware of the threat of the tide. Most of the primary sources I've looked at put this at a 50-50. Most of the staff officers and the intelligence officers are recommending this to both generals Smith and as well as their Navy counterparts that we may have enough water over the reef and we may not. And so everyone realizes or most of them realize that this is a gamble and that they're just not going to know until D-Day, until the day of the landing.
Tell us about that day.
So the day begins according to the American plan, but very, very quickly spirals into chaos.
By the way, which day is this that they actually begin operations?
So this is the 20th of November, 1943. This is D-Day. The fleet has arrived late on the 19th off the coast of Tarawa, just over the horizon. It's the 20th when they'll begin to make their assault.
How large is the fleet?
I think the Americans have about 17 carriers in all. Just to give you an idea of the size there. Of course, there are many supporting vessels and several dozen fire support ships, and the landing force will be the 2nd Marine Division. They'll initially send 2 regiments of that division ashore, with 1 regiment in reserve. But General Smith will quickly be forced to put that reserve into action. So, you know, the attack, It veers into disorder very, very quickly. The naval bombardment that'll precede the Marines' landing begins at 05 that morning. The landing is set to occur at 08. That'll be H hour, as it's called by the commanders. That this is the moment the Marines will touch down on the beach. But quickly, the American plan splinters into disorder. So the transport ships drop their anchor in the wrong location, and the landing craft struggle to load the right men in the dark, as you can imagine, a difficult task to accomplish, especially without much practice at this point, without much practical experience. So very quickly, the timeline is thrown off. The battleship Maryland loses its communications early in the fight. It actually loses its communications from its own blast effect as it participates in the bombardment. So the Naval Task Force, you know, loses the glue that holds it together, the communications at sea. And with the transports in the wrong location, the landing craft are very quickly delayed in getting to their proper positions. So Admiral Harry Hill, the in command of the Naval Task Force, will delay H hour not once but twice, and he'll eventually push that landing back to 09. He'll delay it by a full 60 minutes. However, that word never gets to the carrier aircraft that are supporting the landing. And so almost from the get-go, the fire support ships and the carrier aircraft are out of sync. They're operating on different timelines. The landing craft are themselves delayed. They'll actually find, the coxswains will find a strong headwind when they finally start heading for the beach. That'll delay them another 15 or 20 minutes. And so the timeline is thrown off from the moment the bombardment begins.
How do they overcome that?
Well, I suppose one answer is a pretty impressive bombardment. At least they try to overcome it with an impressive bombardment. Again, I mentioned we'll have a 3-hour bombardment here. This was a hotly discussed topic. General Holland Smith had wanted much longer preparatory fires before he put his Marines ashore. One of the Navy admirals responsible for the fire support efforts at Tarawa tells his Marines that we don't intend to destroy the island, we intend to obliterate it. And so there's a high degree of confidence that a 3-hour naval bombardment will put to rest any Japanese resistance at the beach. And so some of the Marines are skeptical of that. Some of them are believing what they're told. Unfortunately, for the Marines in those first waves, bombardment is largely ineffective, not because the Americans didn't fire enough, but because the Japanese positions withstood almost anything the American task force could throw at it.
How long does the battle last?
The battle lasts for just 76 hours. That from the time the Marines touch down until they declare Baishio Island secure, less than 3 days. And so that seems like an overwhelming victory. Seems like a very quick and cut and dry battle. But for the Marines that fought there, they take horrific casualties. The beach is strewn with corpses in those first waves, and so a lot of the Marines are just unsettled. They can't believe that they've found this kind of resistance. A lot of the Marines riding ashore in those first waves are confident that this American bombardment has knocked out most any kind of Japanese resistance. One of the, a famous war correspondent for Time magazine, Robert Sherrod, he reports as he's riding ashore, he says, "Surely we all thought no mortal men could live through this bombardment." They're watching the American guns and just can't believe that anyone could survive. But indeed, most of the Japanese defenders are alive and fighting when the Marines get to the beach.
What are some of the factors that overcome that real resistance by the Japanese?
Right. So we have a disordered attack from the get-go for the Americans. We have a determined Japanese defense and very much alive as the Marines get ashore. And those final 20 minutes, 25 minutes heading ashore, the Marines have no fire support. The carrier aircraft have already returned to their ships because of that confused timeline that we mentioned. The naval guns have stopped firing by this point, so the Marines are vulnerable as they get to that beach. And for the first day, the attack really hangs by a thread. It hangs by a thread. What begins to change the momentum on the second day kind of gets back to that Ellis and his theory of the amphibious assault. That is maintaining tempo, building up combat power ashore as quickly as you can. So on the second day, the attack, the tide changes, and the Marines begin to move ashore at a much higher rate. They get their medium tanks ashore. They get their 75-millimeter pack howitzers ashore. These are howitzers that are carried by troops themselves and then assembled in order to fire. So that fire support, that organic fire support, once it's ashore, it really begins to make the difference for the Marines. And air support and naval gunfire are important here too. They remain throughout the battle, but it's really that fire support ashore that begins to change the tide.
You know, we've talked about the landing craft and some of the decision making and the gunfire. Can you talk a little bit about the individual stories? Because I think we tend to forget those sometimes. of the individual Marines, not only their heroism, but what kind of actions they took. Are there some stories that have stood out to you, not only as a Marine, but now as somebody who is studying the battle in depth?
Mm-hmm. I think there are several accounts. Robert Sherrod wrote the wartime correspondent that I mentioned just a moment ago. He wrote a book entitled Tarawa, based on his reporting there with the battle. And so he describes the scene vividly, and it's a great personal account. He references a lot of individual Marines there. And so you do see, you know, part of my study, part of my research reveals this important role of coordination, this important specialist kind of behind the rifleman that serves a very important purpose at Tarawa and beyond, coordinating this trifibious firepower that I call it. But Sherrod and other firsthand accounts certainly reveal an equally important component of American success, and that's the courage of infantrymen charging the beach against all odds. And so Sherrod lays that out. There are many accounts of individual Marines taking heroic action, charging. You know, of course, the units are disordered as they get ashore. They're not familiar with the unit on their left or their right, or their landing craft got out of line. And so many of the Marines are forced to kind of create ad hoc units, right? Colonel David Shoup, who will be one of the regimental commanders, there's a famous anecdote where he tells a Marine to go find his own squad and take it forward, right? This lost Marine on the beach, a young private or corporal displaced from his unit, and Shoup tells him, go make your own squad and lead the attack. And the Marine does it. So there are many, many stories of heroic Marines here and individual actions. And ultimately, you know, despite any kind of material or technological advantage the Americans can bring, what they find at Tarawa is that it's going to take an infantryman with a rifle to clear out these Japanese bunkers. Naval support, air support, artillery can all help, and it certainly does. But at the end of the day, an infantryman with a grenade or a rifle, eventually a flamethrower, will become a very effective but horrific weapon in the Pacific. But it'll take that individual to clear out a stubborn Japanese position.
Do the Marines take those lessons and incorporate them into their planning for future amphibious operations?
They do, and that's probably the most enduring legacy of the battle for Tarawa. That is that American forces take down a laundry list of lessons that they do pay close attention to the mistakes that they made at Tarawa, and they begin to move forward in their approach to amphibious warfare, in how to conduct an assault in the spirit of Ellis, but now against a modern and well-equipped and established enemy. And so they'll take many of these lessons forward. They're going to learn that naval gunfire needs to be measured in days, not hours. The American ships will bombard future objectives for a much longer duration. They're going to learn that those ships need to come in much closer to the shoreline. The proximity of a ship is very important in its effectiveness ashore. They're going to learn that they need to precisely target Japanese positions. The Navy, during the flexes, most of their gunfire support had been what we call area bombing. Meaning they kind of fire at a general area, and they expect that the effects of their ordnance over several salvos will make the effects that they want. But they find at Tarawa that doesn't do for these Japanese positions. They need to target these blockhouses, these bunkers, very precisely. They need to land their naval shells immediately on that target in order to achieve the effect. So naval gunfire will change quite a bit in response to Tarawa.
One thing I always ask our historians, researchers, people working on the dissertation, what is it? What is that one moment in your research thus far that you found that was a surprise, that you said, aha, that's so different than anything that anybody's expected, especially in the primary research when you're going through these old files?
I found, one of my one of my favorite letters I ran across was from a Marine major writing in 1931, and he anticipated some of these very problems. I mean, his prescience was almost on the level of Ellis, I would say. In fact, he was a major by the name of Charles Barrett, for whom we now have a Camp Barrett named down in Quantico. He'll go on to become a major general, and he'll be, in fact, killed during the Pacific War. But Barrett writes in 1931 about how pressing this issue is going to be of getting troops ashore and keeping constant fire support in front of them, both naval gunfire and air support. And that's really one of the tools that the Marines are missing at Tarawa. They haven't quite developed that yet. But he's writing this letter in 1931, and he's speculating on how difficult this task will be in the kinetic environment of an amphibious assault, to remain closely coordinated with one another, to keep the naval gunfire that's, by the way, firing from 7, 8, maybe 9 miles offshore, to keep that gunfire closely calibrated with the troops that are right there on the beach. This is a difficult task. To be able to tell a pilot several hundred feet, maybe several thousand feet overhead, exactly how and where to fly and which target to strike, That's a daunting task while you're being shot at on the beach. And so Major Barrett at that time, really in this personal letter that I came across, he foresaw that. And that's really what the Marines begin to learn at Tarawa. And they'll continue refining that coordination throughout the war.
Captain Chris Hemler, United States Marine Corps, and an instructor here in the History Department of the Naval Academy. Chris, thanks for coming in. Really appreciate
it. Thanks so much. I've enjoyed it.
And to our listeners, thank you very much for listening, joining us again. And if you like the episode, please leave feedback on whatever platform you're listening to this, and have a great day.
Preble Hall is in no way intended to reflect the official positions of the Department of the Navy or the Naval Academy.